This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Here are two of the questions that a Massachusetts judge had to consider before delivering a truly dramatic decision earlier today. Can a person be charged and found guilty of someone's death even if she wasn't with the victim when the victim died? And can she be found guilty of killing someone because she sent text messages urging him to commit suicide? Juvenile court judge Lawrence Moniz believes the answer is yes and convicted Michelle Carter of involuntary manslaughter for encouraging Conrad Roy III to kill himself in 2014.
This court, having reviewed the evidence and applied the law thereto, now finds you guilty on the indictment charging you with the involuntary manslaughter of the person Conrad Roy III.
Conrad Roy committed suicide, succumbing to carbon monoxide inside his truck after Michelle Carter encouraged him to get back in the truck. WBUR senior reporter David Boeri was at the courthouse in Taunton today. And David, a really dramatic decision. What can you tell us about the thinking behind the judge's ruling?
Anthony, it was dramatic. We have to explain up front, involuntary manslaughter is a catch-all phrase. Now, in order to win a conviction, the government has to prove, among other things, that the defendant actually was the cause of the death. So the judge started this by separating a time period. The first time period included all the texts. The second time period began after the last text was sent, and phone calls followed the text. The judge found that in the first part, considering all the text, the government had failed to prove that Michelle Carter actually caused the death. She was wanton and reckless, didn't cause the death. As for the second part of what ensued after the text messages ended, there were two phone calls between Carter and Conrad Roy. He was in a truck. The truck had carbon monoxide fumes. They were building up. And as the judge said, he broke the chain. Whether he was intending to commit suicide or not, he broke the chain, left the truck, and he was breathing oxygen, air. At this point, according to the judge, Carter realized he was outside the truck. She told him to go back into the truck. And he went back into the truck and to the carbon monoxide. She could hear the fumes. She could hear him. She could hear him coughing. She heard this, according to the judge. And this is the definition of involuntary manslaughter, wanton and reckless. And for that, she was convicted.
Mm. Now, David, I understand that the judge went back to, what, two old cases to find a precedent for this ruling?
Yeah, and this goes to the nature. See, we don't have involuntary manslaughter is not codified in law. There's no description. So he goes to case law. One of them goes back to 1816 in Northampton. A prisoner is sentenced to be hung the next day for murdering his father, and a cellmate in the jail talks him into hanging himself before the government hangs him. He does that, and the Commonwealth charged the cellmate, and the judge today, Judge Moniz, made sure that everyone knew this is not precedent-setting in what he's doing here, but following law. And the second one, which goes to 1999 in the Worcester fire, the warehouse fire, created through the SJC, the state's highest court, through their interpretation, it emphasized that when someone commits or creates a risk that could probably result in harm, great harm, that person, the defendant, has an obligation to report, a duty to report. She, Michelle Carter, did not do that in the case of Worcester. They didn't notify the firefighters. So that's the principle of involuntary manslaughter.
So, David, very quickly, what are the implications, in your view, of this ruling?
So, first of all, we have in the statutes, we have nothing that criminalizes encouraging suicide. We also have nothing that states that people have an obligation, a duty to report harm being done. So already the ACLU has stepped into this and objected to the ruling today. It will clearly be appealed. There are some big issues. One of them in this case is whether or not Carter created the risk. We know that the two people in the warehouse in Worcester created the risk because they were at the center of the fire that consumed the building and killed the firefighters. Did she create the risk? That's a variation of this question. Did she make Conrad Roy commit suicide? The judge today in his ruling basically said, yes, she's the cause of death. That's going to be appealed, and I think there's going to be an energetic appeal.
Really, really interesting story. David, thank you so much for your reporting. That's WBUR senior reporter David Boeri in Taunton. Let's turn now to our Week in Review panel for their reactions to this decision. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti opinion page. Tom, welcome back. Always good to see you.
Pleasure to be here.
And Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Michael, welcoming you here for the first time. Welcome and thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Anthony.
So let's start. Reactions to this really stunning decision by the judge in the Carter verdict. Tom, I'll start with you.
So I was really surprised. I thought that just on free speech grounds alone, sort of First Amendment grounds, that this was going to be a hard one to get a conviction in. I think the judge's theory about her actions creating a duty to act is kind of novel. And it's not clear to me, as you know, we heard from the reporting just now, that that duty to act really was created. But I think that's what he really holds it on. That normally, if you see someone walking off a cliff, for example, you don't have an obligation to go save that person. But one could imagine circumstances where you would have that obligation. And that's clearly what the judge is trying to create here and saying that because Michelle did not call the authorities when she knew that, in fact, the carbon monoxide was going into the truck, she becomes the cause of death there.
Well, she becomes the cause of death in the judge's view because she not only didn't call for help, but she also said at one point he hesitates and he's out of the truck and she says, get back in.
Get
the truck.
Back in. Yeah. Right.
Michael Jonas, your response.
Well, I also was really surprised by it. But I think to this point about whether she was the actual cause of it, it's interesting that Conrad Roy had on several occasions attempted suicide. He was obviously, deeply disturbed, not well. The same is true of Michelle Carter. But I think that what was interesting or what's interesting often about people suffering from depression or of attempted suicide is that, experts will say often they're really not looking to kill themselves. It's a cry for help. So, although I think the defense tried to say he had a strong inclination to kill himself, I think you could also argue that he really was calling out for help. And when he reached out to her instead of help, what he got was kind of a perverse version of assisted suicide. In other words, assisting someone who, unlike someone with a terminal illness, someone who may well really not have wanted to die, or at least I think that's sort of what the judge's thinking seemed to be.
We heard David Boeri talk about the response from the ACLU of Massachusetts. I'm going to read just a part of that statement. Mr. Roy's death is a terrible tragedy, but it is not reason to stretch the boundaries of our criminal laws or abandon the protections of our Constitution. There is no law in Massachusetts making it a crime to encourage someone or even to persuade someone to commit suicide. So, Tom, we heard David saying this will surely be appealed. I guess that would be the grounds for the appeal. Right?
Well, in an appeal, the question becomes this new law that's being created, how far does it go? It's one view, I suppose, is that Michelle Carter's actions here may be just simply unique. Maybe this interpretation of the law that the judge gave will only apply to her and really to no one else. But you could imagine it being taken further. So, for example, if someone commits suicide as a result of watching the Netflix show 13 Reasons Why, is Netflix now responsible for that because they, in effect, are advocating reasons to kill yourself?
Deep question. Yeah. What do you think, Michael Jonas? I mean, it does sort of bring us into this world of words that kill in a virtual world of text messaging. It's right. Sort of mind-boggling.
Right. And I don't think I had, in my mind, taken it as far as Tom's Netflix thinking. But I was thinking even in the, in the social media world where, people are Snapchatting or sending out group texts, would some kind of a text that just was blasted out to a large group that suggested something and then one out of the 30 people who get it then act on it, will that become sufficient grounds for charging somebody?
Yeah. Well, if I tell you to shoplift something and you do, am I responsible?
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, it's a fascinating case, and obviously it goes without saying, and also a tragic story, the poor young man. Let's switch gears. I want to ask you both about the really shocking shooting at a congressional baseball practice in Alexandria, Virginia on Wednesday, in which four people were injured, including Louisiana Congressman and the House Majority Whip Steve Scalise, who remains in critical condition. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan on the floor of the House.
We are united. We are united in our shock. We are united in our anguish. An attack on one of us is an attack on all of us.
We know the shooter who died in the shootout with police had been a volunteer for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, obviously a very troubled man, the shooter. Michael Jonas, what's your reaction to this shooting on Wednesday? What did it make you think about?
Well, I mean, I hate to make the connection to the case we were just talking about, because they're obviously quite different. But the analogy, it seems to me, is that the broader context is that we're talking about this incredible polarization and coarsening of our political debate, and which is certainly a fact of life today. But then the question is, I mean, do you draw a connection between that? Is that the cause of people like this shooter, this unhinged guy, kind of going loose with guns? And, you know, Bernie Sanders was quick to, you know, issue all the requisite kind of statements and contrition about what had happened. But there was this, again, this sort of connection between speech and then the actions of somebody obviously far out at the fringe.
Yeah. Well, Tom, it's true. I mean, it's an interesting, I mean, it's such a toxic and divisive time in our sort of political moment here in this country. I mean, is this a sort of wake-up call about that?
So I was in Washington, D.C. at the time of the shooting, and I will tell you, people were really shaken by it.
Yeah.
And the first thing you saw was an outpouring of people saying, you know, geez, you know, we really have to come together. That's what Paul Ryan was saying, that one attack on one is attack on all of us. And I have to confess, I veer between cynicism and optimism on this. You know, the cynical part of me says, just like every other shooting that happens, people decry it, people say we need to change it, and nothing really does. On the other hand, you are seeing some members of Congress perhaps getting a little bit of a comeuppance here and saying, you know, maybe some of their language has been intemperate. Maybe rather than just vilifying someone and saying you hate someone and that they're an evil person because they disagree with you, maybe you can just disagree. And it would be nice. I'm probably more cynical on this one, but there is a piece of me that thinks maybe the climate changes a little bit because of this.
Governor Charlie Baker got a little emotional on Wednesday when he talked about the tradition of this congressional baseball game, which, by the way, was played last night in front of 22,000 people. I mean, that's something in and of itself, because I gathered that usually just a few thousand people show up. But
they're not very good.
They're not very good. But here's Charlie Baker talking about the tradition, the importance of the tradition of this congressional baseball game.
I would just say that, you know, that game in Washington is one of the few events in D.C. that creates good feeling between Republicans and Democrats and members of the House and members of the Senate.
So, by the way, the Democrats beat the Republicans 11-2, but then gave the trophy to Steve Scalise, or at least to his office while he's recovering, we hope. But Michael Jonas, speak to the point that Tom raised. Tom said he veers between being optimistic and cynical about whether this will sort of, you know, engender some kind of coming together. What do you think?
I mean, I also waver. I guess I tend to think that you know, there'll be a calm before we return to the storm. I guess that's, you know, that's the best way to put it. I don't think that it's going to reset things in a long-term way.
You know, we were reminded of the shooting of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords outside a supermarket in Tucson 6 years ago, when there was a push for gun safety, when there was a push for members of Congress to come together. But no gun control legislation even got out of a subcommittee, and congressional approval dipped to record lows. So that would suggest that I don't know, maybe more of the same ahead.
Right. I certainly don't think you're going to see any gun legislation.
Right.
Yeah,
that was my next question. Yeah.
In fact, I mean, this has just served to, I think, polarize that debate further, because there's been a pretty strong argument put forward by gun rights advocates that, you know, that more death, deaths were avoided and more injuries by the presence of Capitol officers with guns, and that the only thing better would have been if there'd been more people with guns there.
Right. The argument that the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun was sort of proved true that day, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's move on. I want to talk about two big departures, impending departures from Boston. The CEO of Boston-based General Electric, Jeff Immelt, announced this week that he was stepping down after 16 years at the company. He spoke to employees on Monday.
16 years is a long time. To run this company, even though I love you all dearly, it's long enough. And change is good.
Change is good. He took over the company just 5 days before 9/11. He led GE through the financial crisis. He oversaw the sale of GE Capital, and he oversaw the move of GE headquarters to Boston. So, given all these changes and what GE has been through, Tom Keene, what's his legacy? What's Immelt's legacy?
Let's see. When he came in 2001, the stock was at $60, and when he exited, it was at $32.
That's part of the legacy, then.
That's certainly a big legacy.
Yeah.
And I think that probably speaks to why he left.
Yeah.
I think, obviously, Bostonians are thrilled with the fact that he moved the headquarters here, and that gain is clearly Connecticut's loss. I think that what GE is looking for is a new leader who perhaps can start to bring the stock back to $60.
Right. Interesting. So, Michael Jonas, what do you see as Jeff Immelt's legacy here in Boston?
Well, I mean,
and for GE.
Yeah. I mean, I think here in Boston, and we are the hub of the universe, so of course we'll think about it in our own terms. So I think his legacy is, frankly, that he brought the company here. I mean, we really didn't get to know him well. I was trying to think if the right metaphor is that this was, you know, sort of an arranged marriage between Boston and GE or something, and then suddenly at the altar, you know, one of the parties, you know, was subbed out, and we're now going to get John Flannery suddenly as the guy. The sort of the GE half of this marriage, but I don't know yet, you know, what that'll mean. And the focus here has been, you know, is this going to shift their focus? Are they not going to be as committed to Boston as they seemed under Jeff Immelt? And I would suspect they are. I mean, this is a big change, a big move that was made with a lot of input from the company more broadly than just the CEO. And so I don't think it's going to be a big change for Boston.
Absolutely. I mean, I think worrying about this as being a CEO issue is to misunderstand how involved a board of a company would have been in a decision as consequential as moving its headquarters. That board was clearly involved and clearly signed off on it. And Jeff Immelt's departure had been planned for quite some time and was certainly under discussion. And I think the transition was under discussion during the move, maybe even before the move.
All right. So let's talk about another big departure. Harvard's first female president, Drew Faust, announced that she will step down a year from now. We learned that this week. In a letter to the community, she wrote, "It has been a privilege beyond words to work with you all to lead Harvard through change and through storm." She led Harvard through the Great Recession. Also, she led a capital campaign that has raised $8 billion to date. And in her 2017 commencement speech, she spoke about the Harvard student body today.
Once overwhelmingly white, male, Protestant, and upper class, Harvard College is now half female, majority minority, religiously pluralistic, with nearly 60% of students able to attend because of financial aid.
And here's Bill Lee, senior fellow of the Harvard Corporation, Harvard's governing body, talking about Faust's central accomplishments.
I think the most important may be her efforts and success in integrating across university and opening up the university to a more diverse, more eclectic, frankly, more interesting student body than we might otherwise have had.
So, Michael Jonas, jump in and sort of assess Drew Faust's legacy here. And it seems like a lot of people are talking about this commitment to diversity at Harvard.
And I think she did bring that. I think that the broader picture, I think, you know, is that I think Drew Faust provided sort of steady but not overly colorful leadership. I don't think that she was a frankly, a particularly huge figure on the scene here in Boston. I'm not sure what kind of a figure she cut, you know, nationally in higher ed circles. I think she certainly, you know, did a, you know, was steady and did a good job. I mean, it's a reflection of really what being the president of these huge universities now is, that we're talking about the fact that the endowment took a huge hit in the recession, and then counterbalancing that with the fact that she exceeded even the initial goals of that capital campaign, which I think were $6.5 billion to be $8 billion. So it tells you a lot about the enterprise of being, you know, the president of a huge research university today.
Right, right. All about raising big money, Tom.
I think take a look also at who she succeeded, who was Larry Summers. And, you know, Summers was...
Not being colorful might have been what the doctor ordered, right?
Right. So Larry was definitely colorful, definitely, you know, an intellectual spark. I think so much so that a lot of people got too much aflame from it. What they looked for in Drew was exactly what they got, which is steadiness. And at the same time, and really to her credit, Harvard now more represents America than it ever did before.
Yeah.
And that's really important if what you really think of this institution as a sort of a training ground for America's leaders. Having said that, the really fascinating thing will be who's next. Do the Board of Overseers try to go and get another steady hand a la Faust, or do they try to go for maybe more intellectual firepower?
All right, we have about a minute left, so I'm going to ask you guys both to be really brief and go through our hubbubs, those brief stories that might not have trended on Twitter but caught our attention. Michael Jonas, let me start with you.
So my hubbub is for Marianne Aden, who is a graduating senior at the City on a Hill Charter School in Roxbury. She wrote a piece, or she delivered a speech recently at the school. We posted it on our website at Commonwealth Magazine. Marianne is one of 12 kids, six of whom were born in a Somali refugee camp.
Wow.
She ended up in this country. She's graduating from City on a Hill. She's heading to Bridgewater State University. We hear these stories a lot. We think that they are, you know, nice, gauzy, positive takes, but we kind of can be a little jaundiced by them. I think they're inspiring, and we really ought to stop at each of these and really admire and take inspiration from them.
Great story. Tom Keene, can you do it in 10 seconds?
No. Not possible. But I'll quickly tell you, I was going to do a piece about how the AP is changing its style book for how we describe addiction. It sounds like it's very politically correct. Now we have to talk, instead of talking about addicts, we talk about people with addicts. But you know what? If talking about people with problems means that they're more likely to get medical treatment for those problems, I'm all for a little bit of political correctness.
All right. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor, and Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Thank you both. Have a great weekend.
Pleasure.
There's more ahead. This is Anthony Brooks.